Greetings to you, my beautiful, sweet human family. You're listening to a new dad. I just had my second son. Well, I didn't obviously I didn't have my son, but I went through a very long, beautiful labor process with my very beautiful, very fertile goddess wife, whose breasts are now dripping streams of golden milk that my second son is suckling at. I'm in the Garden of Eden over here, and that means that we're not going to have some kind of complex intros for the next month or so. We're just going to cannonball right into the episode. I'm going to take paternity leave so I can enjoy the incredible, psychedelic, primordial, time-destroying experience of being a parent to a newborn. Today's guest is a dear friend of mine. I went to college with him. Not only did I go to college with him, I traveled through India with him and Emil Amos, the musician who sometimes shows up on the DTFH. We parted ways, and David McLean had a pretty hair-raising experience in India, which you can read about in his first book, The Answer to the Riddle is Me. And it's one of my favorite, I guess you'd call it an adventure travel book meets like William Burroughs' Naked Lunch. That's all I'm going to say about it. Just trust me, it's really good. And he has outdone himself again with his newest book, a novel called How I Learned to Hate in Ohio. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. I hope that you will order both of his books. Before you do that, strap in, my sweet darlings, and welcome back to the DTFH, the brilliant author, David McLean. David, the last time you came on, you had written, I guess, kind of an autobiography? Not really. It's like what's the genre that you would call it?
Memoir.
A memoir. And a brilliant memoir about something incredible that happened to you in India, and terrifying. And it really is just not blowing smoke here, and it's not because you're my favorite. It's one of my favorite books.
Oh,
I love it. And a lot of people who were introduced to you via this podcast have really enjoyed that book. But
that's really great. Thank you.
Now you go and write a genius novel? What are you doing to us, David? How dare you?
How dare you take like 7 years to do it?
I believe you. It's that good. And it's, you know, it's not just, you know, like when your friends make stuff, you have this sense of like, God, I hope it's good. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like love your friends. But then when you realize, what the fuck, this is genius. It's really exciting. Cause it's like, I went to college with him. It's, man, this is like, I love it because, I've been reading all these hardcore like Buddhist books, mm-hmm. and to take a break from that to just jump into this book, which just, I don't like, you've done the thing that I, when as an eternally aspiring writer, I'm always curious about how authors create readability. You know what I mean? Like you can encounter books that are good and the language is like flowery and feels like it's coming from another realm. Like, I don't know, like Tolkien or something. Those are good books. I've read all of them, but sometimes they're slow reading.
Right.
You know what I mean? But then some books you dive into and you feel like you've jumped into like a river, like that's just a flowing so fast. So it's a delight. You know, that's my favorite. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But those are the best books. This is like that. You know what I mean?
Oh,
it's like
thanks.
Powerful. That the what you are talking about and the symbols you're using to talk about things that I don't even know how to address as a podcaster are powerful. But also, you've got this like wildly great book. I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep. I'm not going to rave on and on about it. But congratulations!
Oh, please do.
Tell me about it, man. Tell me about those 7 years.
Please
writing do. This thing.
You know, the 7 years between these books was a crazy time. You know, my memoir was about losing my memory. And I was still sort of dealing with it when I wrote the book. And then some time went on and I felt like I had boxed that trauma up. Like I had gotten to better terms with it. And then like 2 years after, and I'm going to say this because I know you're expecting your second child, but like 6 weeks after my son was born, I went into the hospital for a routine surgery and went into cardiac arrest. Respiratory arrest, and had to be in the ICU for 4 days. And then I was just, all of that trauma that I thought I had dealt with was reactivated, and right back into it.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, that's the nature of trauma, though. It's like, as soon as you have another traumatic experience, it just brings all that other trauma forward. And it was awful, just absolutely awful. And so I had to like deal with it again. And this time the way I dealt with it was I started writing this book. And so I wrote it in a kind of trauma fugue. And because of that, like it brought up all this trauma from high school that I definitely had boxed up, hadn't thought about, put away. But then the trauma.
Yo-yo fag, is that from your high school?
Yeah, I was called that.
You were called yo-yo fag.
I was called yo-yo fag. Briefly.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. When I went and talked to a teacher about it, a teacher I really liked, and I told him that this guy was calling me that, he bust out laughing.
Oh God.
And so it was just like, but it sucks. But the teacher just thought it was the funniest thing.
Well, this is, you know, not to shoehorn Buddhism into this, damn it. I've been just on a Buddhist rampage lately, but I'm sorry.
Buddhist rampage.
It's my favorite video game.
Oh.
I take your suffering and give you my joy. the idea in Buddhism of the hell realms, you know, the there are these, like, you know, there is the possibility mythologically to reincarnate in a place where you're being sort of dipped in molten lead over and over again.
Jesus.
And all you're doing is screaming forever. It's probably a metaphor for high school. You know what I mean? Like you can, you know, like you can, what's different between that? I mean, clearly you're not being boiled in molten metal, but it's more sophisticated than that. You know, it's like you're a kid,
yeah,
and the protector, the person who's supposed to help you, is demonically laughing.
Yeah.
At you being bullied.
Yeah.
How is that not hell?
Right. Right. And that, like, your suffering is clear amusement for someone else. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it sucked. And also, I would say your skin is on this weird slow boil where, like, these pustules are just coming up. Ugh. And you don't know what you're going to look like from day to day.
That's right. You have a pox.
You have a pox.
An Old Testament style pox. Like, and the pox seems to somehow coincide with a crush that you have. You're falling in love somehow. It's impossible that you would be, but you're experiencing like maybe in your entire life a love of such purity, because you don't know about impermanence. You don't understand about taxes. You don't understand about pragmatic utilitarian sex.
No.
You know what I mean? But your blisters, your zits are appearing to like harmonize with your crushes. You remember that? Like you're like getting one on your nose and your nose balloons out.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember every once in a while maybe trying to put a Band-Aid over one?
Brilliant.
Which just makes it so much worse and so much more visible.
Yeah, you might as well like figure out a way to like mount some kind of spotlight apparatus that shines a spotlight directly on the zit, because everybody knows what it is.
And same thing with like young women putting on foundation over their acne riddled face.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see like how the foundation is sort of cracked like a bad sidewalk.
Oh, yeah.
It's so awful.
Yeah. And, you know, I think also like mixed into there's so many different things like happening, which is probably you do have some hormonal stuff happening. So your emotions are already like wildly out of balance. But then on top of that, you are existing in some kind of state imposed hell realm where people your age they've never heard the word compassion.
Right.
You know what I mean? So all they know how to do, and God knows I was one of them, man.
Oh yeah.
I remember being sucked and vacuumed up into the, like, just you what are you going to do? You're either someone holding the pitchfork or you're somebody getting stabbed, man. You know? Yeah. So, but yeah, acne is like, that's it. That's one of the things. Wow. I forgot.
Yeah. Awful.
This episode is sponsored by Blue Chew. My loves, we're not exactly in what you would call the most erotic time period in human history. So if you're looking for a little extra confidence in the sack, it's time for you to check out BlueChew.com. That's blue, like the color blue. Blue Chew, it brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. It's made in the USA. It's prescribed online by licensed physicians, so you don't have to go to the doctor or wait in line. It's even cheaper than a pharmacy, and they prepare and ship it right to you in a discreet package. No awkwardness, and you don't need to leave the house. It comes in this little completely innocuous cardboard envelope that contains within it a ticket to you making love like you were back in college, where you used to bang and get banged down in those amazing college orgies. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. You can visit bluechew.com and get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code Duncan. You just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BLUECHEW.com, promo code Duncan to try it for free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper choice, and I thank them for sponsoring the podcast. And remember, when you support our sponsors, you help make this podcast possible. But honestly, who cares about that? The truth is, this is a magical medicine that I have tested many, many times for you just to make sure it keeps working, and it has never failed me, a 46-year-old man with one ball and scoliosis. So it will definitely work for you. That's BLUECHEW.com, promo code Duncan. You can try it for free. Thank you, Blue Chew. So you're having something that, even without having a family, is terrifying, but now having add to your brush with your second brush with your own mortality, the fact that you have a family that you could lose.
Yep.
And so this like connected you to an earlier trauma.
Yeah, like the trauma.
Wow.
And so as I wrote, I was able to connect with that experience of being bullied really well. And just remembering just that feeling of having to go into school every day and knowing that it was just going to be awful.
Wow.
Right? Yeah, like the getting ready for school, like picking out clothes and being like, which one will they hate less?
Wow.
Yeah.
Dude, I remember, so my mom took me shopping. And I don't know why I thought this would be a good idea, but I decided, you know what? I'm going to start wearing really nice, like button-up clothes. And I think your mom just recognizes that their kid is like, they don't know for sure what's happening, but they know it's not great. Mm-hmm. You know, they know you're getting, they don't know what to do. What can you do? You're working. So in some gesture of, I think, confused motherly love, she took me to the mall and bought me these ridiculous corduroy pants, some kind of purple velour-y button-up thing.
Nice.
And I think nice. flag shoes or something. I just remember thinking like, yeah, I'm going to be the kid who dresses good at school. Yeah,
I'm going to be, you know what? I'm going to be a dandy. Let me be a dandy fop in high school and see how well that turns out.
That's definitely going to stop the bullies. They're going to see me and be like, look at that dandy lad. I was going to shove him into a locker, but wow, the velour.
Look how he pulls that off.
I'll never forget. I think I was probably gotten off the school bus, I'd already gotten weird stares from people, but I think it was like 4 minutes walking through the halls when someone yells out, hey, look, it's the Joker.
Nice.
Ooh, it hurts. It hurts. I want to thank BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, like a global pandemic, or maybe your government was almost overthrown by maniacs? BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. This is professional counseling done securely online. There's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log on to your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. And who wants to be in a waiting room right now? BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. You can visit their website, read their testimonials that are posted daily. Visit betterhelp.com/Duncan. That's better H-E-L-P. And join the over 1 million people who've taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. And Duncan Trussell Family Hour listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/Duncan. So, when you sound great, by the way, there was a period when I chatted with you where you were going through a lot, man. I'm trying to think where it landed before or after this, but, I think you had some concern that maybe your experience with Larium had permanently altered you. Do you still feel like that?
Absolutely. There's no doubt. I mean, at a chemical level, it's a neurotoxin. And so it has killed off parts of my brain. And it's just like now, I mean, luckily the brain is plastic and so it can work around damage. But there's damage there that I live with.
Wow.
And it's just sort of getting the right meds, sort of learning how to live with it.
P.S. For those who didn't listen to the last episode with David or miss what we were talking about up front, David experienced a hardcore, awful reaction to the, what do they call it? Anti-malaria?
Yeah, it's an, what if it's a malarial prophylaxis called Larium or Mefloquine.
Mefloquine. And it gave him a amnesia, and which it just is so, that it's such a terrifying thing. So how are you, you know, to me, having not finished this book, but gotten through some of it, I don't think it has done, it seems like you're at least the part of your brain that writes seems to be doing great. But was there a struggle in writing this book? Was there an added challenge on top of all the other stuff of like having to deal with some kind of brain damage while writing this book?
No, I mean, luckily, I mean, this is weird how this works. But I see the stuff I wrote before Larium and the stuff after. And I think the stuff, and maybe this is just the difference between when you're in your 20s and when you're in your 30s and 40s, is the stuff before, it was like I was so desperate to prove to everybody I was smart.
Right.
Like I felt like writing was a cerebral activity and I was going to out clever the world.
Yeah.
And that like a book was just an elaborate prank I was pulling off on the reader. And since then, like, I don't try to do that anymore. In fact, the more I can shut off my brain and just write, listening to the music of the writing and listening to what the characters want and need and how they would react, is so much better than writing brain forward stuff. And I think that's one of the big benefits of whatever brain damage I have, is I'm no longer trying to wrestle the world with just my intellect.
Was it tough to switch from memoir to fiction?
You know, all my studying had actually been in fiction. And so it was really nice to come back to fiction. I had to learn how to write a memoir. It was like this stuff I had to do after school was learn how to write a memoir. But fiction, it was just like, oh, right, I know how to do this. So it was nice to relax back into fiction.
Forgive my, like, I'm going to ask a few just pretty boring technical questions, but I'm always fascinated by the like nuts and bolts of the way good writers do their job. I think it's like a kind of fantasy I have, that like some kind of weird cargo cult idea of like, oh, that's the problem. I'm using the wrong pen or something like that. You know what I mean? But I think all of us who love to write and like want to accomplish what you've done, you know, we just want to know everything. So right. on behalf of all of us, I'm going to ask a few boring Excellent. Questions. So what time of the day do you write?
It changes. I mean, okay. Right now, because of COVID, my kids are out of the house from 3 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my time.
Do you have a preferred time?
No, not really. It's just nice for it to be kind of around the same time every day, because it just sort of gets my brain sort of set for
so, it. So you're 3 hour periods a day?
Yeah.
Does that vary? So 3 hours.
Yeah.
And how do you like, how do you know when to stop?
Oh, I mean, it's just when the time is up.
Oh, because you feel like you could just keep going, but you've got parent stuff that you
got
to do.
I've got all this other stuff. You know, there are some writers who say they like to stop in the middle of a scene so that they know exactly what to do the next day.
Yeah.
And that's helpful. So I'm not just creating a new something out of whole cloth. Instead, I can jump in midstream. But it really is. It's like however far I get, I'm thankful for.
Right. And yeah. How much of the time spent working on this novel, how much in those 3 hour periods or in your working periods, how much of that time is spent with revision versus creation?
I'm one of those writers who writes a lot in my first draft, or write big, messy first drafts all the way through, and then go back and revise and revise and revise.
How do you keep yourself from going back and revising midstream, though? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, there is like that thing where you look at an earlier paragraph, you're like, oh, I got that's shit. I've got to cut that whole sentence out.
Yeah. Well, sometimes, I mean, I got to say, maybe I'm lying a little bit. And I feel like whenever I talk about writing process, I'm always going to be lying a little bit.
Cool.
Because it's acting like I'm in control of it when actually I'm not. I can set up the parameters for engaging with the work, but how it happens is sort of beyond me. But what I find is when I'm starting something, I have to write and rewrite and rewrite a lot just to find tone.
Yeah.
And once I find the tone, I find I can write that large, messy draft because at least I know now the parameters of that tone and how that tone works.
Right. That's cool. So it's like when you're painting, you're going to just you've got to pick out a few colors. Like you're not going to use that. And so is that kind of like what you mean by tone?
Yeah, absolutely. This is how it's going to appear.
Okay, cool. That's cool. Do you, you were mentioning listening to the writing, but do you listen to music while you're doing that?
Always.
What do you listen to?
For this book, I listened to a lot of No Name. Do you know this woman? She's a rapper, Chicago rapper. Just love her work. And what else? I listened to a lot of Spiritualized and John Prine. Just
wow. That's so cool.
Is like Godspeed You Black Emperor and
holy shit.
Yeah.
How do you, especially with John Prine, how do you keep that from bleeding into the writing, or do you care?
God, if I could have it bleed into the writing, I'd be ecstatic.
Oh God, would that be amazing? You know what? I really think that, you know, for better or for worse, we are 10 years out from being able to like take ingredients like I'm gonna grab some John Prine, The Shining, let's throw in this picture of like an old boot by a railroad track, and then I'd like to mix in I don't know, Mount St. Helens explosion.
Right.
And you give that to an AI and you're like, so make like a really cool dystopian sci-fi out of that. Back the next day and you've got a whole book.
Amazing.
It would be.
Yeah. Because I think that's what we do on an intuitive level. And so if it actually could be written into code, into if then, if this, then that, that would be amazing.
Well, this is, you know, not that long ago, you hear like Elon Musk, he's shitting bricks over AI. And, you know, you want to listen to him because, you know, what the fuck am I doing? I'm podcasting. He's like launching people into space. you know, so you would think he might have like some edge on us, but then also it feels like an overreaction. But I just read that some AI is producing comments that they did a study and there no one could differentiate the AI's comments online from a regular person's. And you know, in every one of these announcements, it really poses like a legitimate threat to industries that felt immune
right
to the, you know, automation. Yeah. You know, but this is the part it feels like you're getting at when you're talking about your process, this sense of like, who the fuck is writing this?
Right.
You know what I mean? It's already an AI writing it, is what I mean. Like, so I guess it would make sense that this, we would be able to disembody the process.
Yeah.
Do you think you would be AI phobic when it came to your reading choices? Like, you know what I mean? Like, would you feel like you would only read human books, or would you feel weird reading a book if you knew it was written by a machine?
I think like the first five would be all about novelty and would be all about like, I can see the strings on this. This isn't that clever.
Yeah.
By the sixth one, I'd be deep in. Yeah. I'd start to have favorite AI subsystems. Oh man, Genesis 2. God, it can write a book.
Oh God, did you read the new Genesis 2 book? Well, which one? It comes out with a new book every 5 seconds. What do you mean? A big thank you to Athletic Greens for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. I'm not trying to vitamin shame anybody out there, but I can't tell you how many times I've gone to a friend's house and slipped on one of their empty vitamin bottles that they've left on the floor. I had to wade through like 50 different vitamin bottles just to get into their kitchen. Athletic Greens fixes that. It's a wonderful powder that's got everything you normally take from your other endless pills, multivitamins, multimineral, probiotic, and prebiotic. Not only that, but they've got vitamin D that you can just drop into your mouth, 2 to 3 drops right in your mouth, or you can mix it in with your Athletic Greens. I know what you're thinking. I don't want another embarrassing powder. I don't want one of those jugs or barrels that my weightlifter friends inevitably have on top of their refrigerator with like a picture of a wolf chewing on a dumbbell on the front and little bits of clotted powdered goop scattered around their kitchen from when they tried to mix the shit up in their blender. This is not Athletic Greens. Athletic Greens sends you a stylish ceramic container that you can put your powders in so you don't look like you're in the middle of some kind of hardcore steroid bender. They understand us, and it's great. A lot of us have busy schedules, poor sleep. Maybe we're not exercising enough right now. Maybe we're just a little too distracted to keep track of an infinite amount of vitamins. I have friends who do the thing where they like organize their vitamins and put them in a bag, and they eat the vitamins like they're in some Aldous Huxley short story about nutrition. It's never been to me. That's not the way I want to live. My mind doesn't work like that, which is why I love my Athletic Greens. It's a life-changing nutritional habit. Their daily all-in-one superfood powder is your nutritional essential. It's by far the easiest and most delicious nutritional habit that you can add to your daily routine today. And they empower you to take ownership of your health by simplifying the logistics of getting optimal nutrition on a daily basis by giving you one thing with all the best things. 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food source ingredients, including a multivitamin, multimineral, probiotic, green superfood blend, and more. It's all in one tasty scoop of Athletic Greens. Support your immune system. This is the time to get healthy. Right now, Athletic Greens is doubling down on supporting your immune system during the winter months. They're offering my sweet audience a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase if you visit my link today. You'll basically never have to buy vitamin D again. You'll have enough for your bomb shelter. Starting 2021 with a simple, sustainable, nutritional habit is Athletic Greens MO. So whether you're looking for peak performance or better health, covering your bases with Athletic Greens makes investing in your energy, immunity, and gut health each day simple, tasty, and efficient. Head over to athleticgreens.com/Duncan and join health experts, athletes, and health conscious go-getters around the world who make a daily commitment to their health every day. Again, simply visit athleticgreens.com/Duncan and get your free year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs today. Adding vitamin D to your daily routine is a great way to support vitamin D production during the colder months when there's less sun exposure. There's something they're leaving out of this, and I understand. I'm sure there's a reason why, but just look up other great reasons why you might want to take vitamin D right now, because there's a big one out there. I want to thank Athletic Greens for sponsoring us. Remember, by supporting them, you support us. Thank you, Athletic Greens. When you say it took you 7 years to write this, do you mean it was just 7 years between books, or it literally took you 7 years?
No, it was 7 years between books. It's probably 2.5 years of writing.
Wow. Do you play around with the idea that even though it was 2.5 years of writing, it was actually 7 years of some kind of subconscious process happening that was already writing the book without you even knowing it?
Yeah, I definitely think that, because like part of what I was doing when I was writing that book about memory loss was actively trying to cultivate my memories. And so I was trying to re-remember my life and using anything I could. And then the trauma happened. And then so the trauma sort of met up with that process of reclaiming my memories. And so it inflected it. And so that's how this book sort of came to being. I would say those 7 years were really essential.
What do you have any theories on memory and time? I know there's clearly like a biological process involved in the creation of memories.
Yeah.
People have tried to explain that to me. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the connection between memory and where we place ourselves in the time-space continuum.
Yeah, I've been really interested in the theories about how dreams function with our memory.
What are those?
Dreams, REM sleep sort of weeds out, is like the first revision of our memories is our dreams.
Okay.
And it sort of like washes stuff out of our memory that we won't need, that it thinks we won't need. And so that's why you, like, the next day, it's hard to remember what you ate.
Yeah.
The previous day, it's because this theory says, like, your REM sleep is sort of editing and discarding a bunch of that.
It's like, I'm going to turn your experience eating that shitty pizza that you cooked into you being eaten by a falcon, and then we're going to be done with it.
And then we're done with it. Right.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I'm interested in that because we have no say in that. But we can work against it, because if you think real hard, you can recapture that memory, right?
Yes.
And so I'm interested in that. And I'm interested in how there's probably memory detritus within us that we just have to figure out how to reactivate in some ways. Because I don't think it's gone forever. I think it's there. It just we've had no use for it.
Right. Yeah, I'm interested in the detritus aspect of it. I'm doing this 30-day meditation challenge thing. You meditate 20 minutes every day. Not a big deal, but you, right around day 17, that started happening where like just fragmented, seemingly unimportant, uninteresting. Yeah. Like today I remembered going to a shopping mall when I was a kid to return this is the early days of computers, to return a external sound card called Sound Blaster that I couldn't get to work on my computer. And the guy was really pissed because I'd wrapped it in the wrong thing. And he's like, "You probably erased it." But what's that? Like that, I haven't had that memory in, I don't know, 15 years. Like, why did that float up to the surface? Right.
These totally useless memories.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in those useless memories because it works against the idea that I'm a useful person.
What do you mean?
Is that like this idea of REM sleep sort of editing out our memories is this idea that it gets rid of the stuff that we have no use for. And I would say, like, I don't want to be a purely useful person. I don't just want to be composed of the things that make my life easier. Right. I want to be composed of the stuff that's aberrant and that makes my life difficult, and the sort of weirdo stuff that I don't know the use for, but it's still part of my experience, so I want it.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That, you know, there's a butcher, like, alien butcher quality, right, to whatever part of ourselves it is that's being like, nope, you don't need this. We're slicing this one out. This one's going. Yeah. Like, instead of having an automatic function in our nervous system that did that, we had to go to some form of doctor.
Right.
Or like, you know, the way people go to get their kidney dialysis or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that we would go there and allow the doctor to sort of make the hierarchy of needs of our memory.
Yeah, like you would see your memories of what you did the last few days on some screen, and he'd be like, "Oh yeah, see, this is the moment that you got up off the couch and went back to the kitchen because you left your coffee there. We don't need that, so we're gonna wipe that." And then you would be like, "Wait, what'd you wipe?" And the doctor would be like, "Don't worry about it."
Don't worry about it. I got it for you.
And then if you consider the collective version of that, that every day all of humanity has excised from their psyche, probably like infinite, like billions of terabytes of theoretically pointless memories, it implies like an antimatter universe of memories.
Yeah. Yeah, and where all of our useless memories go. And what a world to be just purely useless, right? What if you were just composed of your useless bits? Like, what is that personality?
Probably relaxed. You know, usefulness is stressful.
Usefulness is stressful. And also, like, pleasure isn't usually seen as useful. That's why, like, I don't know, like eating a good apple, it's like eating it for the first time. Like, I wonder, like, how many apples have been wiped from my memory because usefulness, I mean, pleasure wasn't seen as useful.
Jesus Christ. Like that poor fucking apple.
Right. Gave
barely
up life.
Tasted. You, maybe it was an apple that you hurriedly ate.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like you didn't barely taste it. And then your mind was like, forget that.
Come
half-assed
on.
Apple bite you took. We're not remembering that back in 1986.
Come
it was
on.
The summer. That was right before your dad burned you with a cigarette. It's wild, man. I've never heard this before, but yeah, it's like the usefulness itself, you know, isn't it kind of wrapped up in like industrial revolution?
Absolutely.
Thinking
this idea that we're going to streamline the process, and what we lose when we streamline the process of ourselves is fascinating. And it's, I will say, this is also the way people will talk about books often, is they'll talk about plot and they'll talk about what they got out of the book, or they'll talk about themes or whatever. And it's like, yeah, but the experience of reading the book was the pleasure of these words coming together and this pleasure of having somebody else's voice singing in your head. Like that's the experience of writing, of reading something good. And I think what happens is people make the mistake that how they read and how they think about reading is how they should go about writing.
Whoa.
And that's not how it works at all.
Oh, wow.
Like if you want to set yourself up for failure, you think a lot about the themes you want to accomplish in your book. You think a lot about like plot, and you really like get it all down before you start writing. That's the worst way to go about writing. It's really like letting go of the handlebars and sort of letting the bike take you places.
But, you know, but the problem is, like, if you want to do like a publishing deal or something, you do have to do that kind of, don't you? Like,
you have to do that sort of talking.
That sort of what?
That sort of talk. You got to write, engage in that sort of talk. You have to put your elevator speech together. You have to do all of that nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
But the great thing about publishing is everybody understands that it can change.
Oh, right. Because they're working with writers. So they know that whatever the fuck you think you're going to write, it's not going to be what.
Yeah.
Which is weird because they're probably buying an idea that they know is going to
change,
transform into something else.
Yeah.
And
if you write exactly what you thought you were going to write, how depressing is that?
Oh, my God.
You went through this whole process and nothing changed. Like, that's so sad.
Good Lord, man. You know, your students are lucky to have you. That's, you know, are you still teaching?
Yeah, still teaching.
Are you doing Zoom teaching now?
Yeah, I love it.
Really?
I do. With my graduate students, I loved it. My undergrads, man, Zoom silence. There's nothing like Zoom silence in a classroom. Stuff and kill you, man. But my grad students, I got to see the inside of their homes.
Oh, yeah.
And there was something just so sweet about it. There was something so intimate about it.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, that is, I think that is the Zoom gift is that it is, thank God, taking everyone down a few notches.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, the illusion of the whatever the presenter may be as being this buttoned up being is immediately destroyed when you see like Jesus Christ, look at that, look at that weird fucking room in their house. These people are maniacs.
You have a bunch of teddy bears on a bookshelf. I was so intimidated of you, and then I saw your bookshelf of teddy bears. I'm cool.
Yeah, you've got a teddy bear bookshelf and you're like talking about like the incoming economic collapse.
Right.
You know, and then it all kind of makes sense. It adds a new dimension. You know, not to like get back into the writing thing, when you're listening to certain types of music, like hyper-produced music, there, all this static, much like the useless memories, gets intentionally wiped out.
Right.
You don't hear the coughs in the recording room. You don't hear doors opening. You don't hear shuffling or rustling. It's all taken out. So you get this thing, which is called like a produced, a produced super expensive song. And then you get lo-fi and all the like stuff like Sebado, and you hear something more. So you feel more connected to it. But with writing, it is a natural filtration. It's like it's so pure, you know what I mean? Because it's just words. Like, and it's words that have been printed on paper over and over and over again. Not only are you losing that thing you get with Zoom, you're losing so much.
Yeah.
And yet, why does it feel like when you're reading a good book, the author's spirit is somehow living inside of it?
It's amazing because, like, the best thing about writing, about really good writing, is when it feels like it's going after things that are beyond language. Like you can feel like the language butting its head against the sort of sublime. Wow. And it's like, that's when writing is so exciting, is like when you're reading the words, but what's going on is something so far beyond words. It's like music, it's rhythm, it's all of this stuff that's sort of just using words to get us to this place beyond words. That's when I get the most excited.
What is that place, David? Why is it that when I'm reading a great book, and this is a great book, I feel like it's not like an illusion or something. I literally feel like connected with your mind. Like, you know what I mean? Like what is that place? Cause I don't mean like, it seems like it, or it's just that's just great writing. I feel like I'm enveloped in the mind of the author.
Right.
It isn't like something like that. It's real. Like in the way, like when I'm walking outside and the wind blows, you know, what is that space? Is there some as of yet unmapped realm that somehow the putting words into sentences and sentences into paragraphs and packaging those into a book somehow teleports us into? Are we literally, do you think people are literally sharing some kind of mind space when they're reading a book?
I think what's happening is they're creating a mid space between the writer and themselves. And they're creating this sort of place in between that.
All right.
You get a lot of these stuff from the writer, but so much you supply yourselves. And so you sort of have this joint area that feels like one of the most intimate things in the world. Right? Because it's something that you've created that you have ownership of, but also that you don't, right? You know what's not yours, but you feel so entangled with another brain. I feel like that's another soul, actually, not a brain. Like you feel like entangled with another self. And that's to me, everything.
Everything. The familiarity, you know, it's a weird thing reading a book that your friend wrote because I do know you, but other great books that I've read, it's that really poignant familiarity with this being that you've never met.
Yeah.
I was doing a podcast with this wonderful musician called Daedalus, and they were saying that they have a theory, and I would love to know what you think about this, that at the quantum level, every time a song is listened to, it changes it a little bit.
Huh.
What do you think about that with writing?
That's interesting, because that's the theory about memory, right? That every time you remember something, you change it molecularly.
Yes.
And that this idea that every time you listen to a song, you change it.
I guess, like, so I love the idea that there. So here's a book. So that here's an incredible book, and then here's the reader, and that there's a number one. It adds a kind of contribution that the reader is giving to that space. It keeps it. Obviously, there's no way for this like a book without a reader is just a bundle of fucking paper with weird shit on it. It's nothing. It doesn't exist. The reader brings it to life or recreates it, but. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting too woo here or asking you more. I'm like asking you to get too woo, but do you think is that space unique to the reader? Or is there some possibility that a book is a map that draws consciousness into a kind of shared collective zone at any given time that you're reading a popular book, you're in that space with countless other people.
Right. Yeah, and maybe that's why it's such a charge to read something outside of what anybody you're surrounded with is reading. That in some ways you get to experience new territory. And that's why sometimes like reading popular books, only popular books, sort of starts to feel, I don't know, like you're just always on guided expeditions or cruise packages. Like when you do some like extreme reading and go out and find stuff that nobody else is reading, that it feels like, oh shit, this is new territory.
Anything come to mind when you say that, like extreme reading? Like does any kind of off the top of your head, any example of that pop into your head?
You know, I've been reading this woman, Rebecca Brown, and she's a nonfiction writer. She's an essayist, but she's doing stuff that I can't believe she's doing.
Like what?
Well, she, you know, nonfiction has this built-in idea that what we're writing is true.
Yeah.
But what she's doing is she's a gay writer, and she's saying that like her identity, the history of her identity has been sublimated throughout history. And so she's reclaiming this sort of imaginative space of what is fact. When you've been sort of kept out of the factual history of the world.
Yeah.
Then what is fact to you? And that has gotten really exciting. And she fucks with you in terms of like mixing fact and fiction. And it's amazing stuff.
Wow, that's so trippy. Wow, that's
her
so
essay, weird. The Priests is just sublime. It's so good. It comes out of a book called American Romances, and it's just so good.
How do you find these books? I mean, like, what's your, who's recommending these as someone who's a.
My students.
No shit. They just say, hey, do they call you what do they call you? Mr. David. Or professor? Okay.
No, I really think like, I always make a point to ask my students what they're reading because they're out there reading stuff that I would never come across. And so it's the greatest. I got a pile of books from this last semester from all the things my students recommended for me. And they're brilliant, all of them.
You know, another thing that I think people accidentally forget, or maybe they don't mention it, is like when you're reading a good book, you're under this temporary spell. Yeah. You know, like every single day is going to be colored a little bit by that book and the love you feel for the book, you know, that exhilaration you feel that you've finally found a book you like again, you know, and it's like, oh my God, this is so wonderful. And it's like the opposite of a curse. A great book gives you this blessing. And if it is a dark book, even if it's like your world is a little creepier, it's still a blessing because it's just, the book ends. But I wonder what you think as an author about like Twitter and looking at it from the same perspective, in the sense like you follow like Trump and it doesn't end. You know what I mean? And somehow there's like an insidious creep that gets into you via all the information streams that you've chosen to like absorb. And it's a true curse. What are your thoughts on that, man? Do you like right now the big debate among people who authentically tried to do a coup,
right,
is that they should be allowed to plan overthrows of governments online without being censored, that it's, you know what I mean? But not just that, they should be allowed to, you know, voice complete lies that are designed to make people take political action in one form or the other that is based on misinformation, and that it's like dangerous. Even Jack at Twitter said, well, it's a dangerous precedent that I did. What are your thoughts regarding that? I'm sorry if it's a circuitous way to get to your thoughts on free speech as we grapple with the internet.
Yeah. I gotta say, Twitter is just a panic attack for me. I try to minimize my contact with it as much as I can, because I finally took it off my phone. I got off Facebook. I just couldn't handle it anymore. I like my Instagram because it's filled with cosplayers. So I love looking at people making handcrafted vision costumes. Like, I'm ecstatic about that shit.
What's a vision costume?
You know, the Marvel character Vision.
Oh.
Like some low rent foam core Vision that got made out of shit bought at Michael's.
Foam core? Did you say foam core?
Yeah.
Is that a term or what is that?
It's a material.
Oh, it's literally called foam core.
Yeah, it's called foam core.
I thought it was like a movement or a cosplay genre, foam core.
It should be. I've gone full foam core on this bitch.
Why did you decide to start? Why? Why are you into cosplay? I'm not in any way saying why. I mean, you should see my fucking Instagram. It's like either like pictures of like Buddhist saints or like just like smutty hot models or like friends. It's like a terror, or people playing synthesizers. It's like a terrible. Wow. Yeah, I know, man. I don't know.
Like what you were talking about before, the AI that could put together John Prine and Mount St. Helens and whatever. You've done that. You've created that.
Yeah, I have. It's like a beautiful, beautiful, enlightened being that is kind of into like fetish stuff, but also is like Pink Floyd.
Right.
Or something like that. I'll take it, by the way. Oh my God. Yeah. Imagine that. If you could turn your Instagram feed into a living being, what would it do to you?
Yeah.
What would yours do to you? If you took your Instagram feed and ran it through some kind of matter assimilator and had a human-sized thing, what would it look like and what would it do to you?
It would be sort of a fascinating sort of fetishy, kinky, nostalgia machine that had the face of my cousin's baby.
Oh my God, that's so wild. What a confusing machine.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah,
and I don't know what it would do to me, but I can say it would probably look like a homemade Catwoman costume with my cousin's baby's face.
Man, this is, do you have any internet problem? Like as a writer, do you, are you, do you like, how do you deal with the addiction, man? Like how are you maintaining any kind of focus when it comes to writing and reading with these terrible gravity fields that are coming out of our phones?
Yeah, it's awful. It's awful. I don't know. Especially when your phone also can stream anything.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Have you noticed, I'll tell you, as a comedian, I was at the Denver Comedy Works and Dave Chappelle had been there and he left those bags people have to put their phones in that they get back when they leave.
Uh-huh.
And I was backstage listening to a room where people couldn't use their phones. And it was a completely different sound.
Wow.
Than a room where people are looking at their phones before a show, and a completely different mood. But as a writer, and also as someone who's like encountering people at various stages in their development as a writer, have you noticed any like over your years of encountering them? Do you think there's been any kind of like change that's related to absorption into their phones?
It's interesting. Over my course as a writer, I've seen people write more and more fragmented stuff, more collage-y stuff. And I wonder if that's sort of this thing of trying to integrate your personality and your thoughts with all of this unlimited data coming at you.
Yeah.
Like what you're getting is these sort of beautifully fragmented, faceted pieces. Because that's what experience is like. I feel like that. I feel like if I was going to say if anything's changed, but maybe that's just because last semester, that's what everybody was doing. But it feels like that.
We'll never know. I mean, you know, you see, like, I saw this picture of a wasp nest, maybe. But somehow the wasps had figured out how to use plastic in the nest. Yeah. And it was pretty and like also like blasphemous, you know. Yeah. It's like, we'll never know. We do have these great books from pre-internet, but we'll never know if like our technology is acting as a kind of like, is doing the same thing to whatever that was creating those books in the past that garlic does to vampires.
Yeah.
You know, like it's impossible. The technology, or is it helping? Is it helping us? I mean, it's a stupid question, but.
Right. It's neither, of course.
Yeah.
Right. It's neither. It's the one great thing about the internet is the democratization of knowledge and the ability to sort of open up publishing routes for lots of different voices.
Right.
But who knows, like, what it's damaging, like our ability to pay attention, our ability to see a thought through from a single perspective. But that also could be a positive. Who needs to just see something from a single perspective anymore when you can have 20 perspectives?
Yeah. Yeah. We don't know. And also it's a process. We don't know what it's turning into. I mean, it's still in an intermediary phase where still have an externalized device. I'm sure it's a matter of time before, phones are going to be melted into our heads.
Yeah.
And then who knows what that's going to be.
David. And then that will collapse and we'll enter into a new phase.
Yeah, exactly.
Like it just doesn't stop.
It doesn't stop. And it seems to be accelerating. This is one of my wife was listening and I don't know, I don't really want her to listen to the podcast because she has to like listen to my ass all day long every day. But she was listening to, one of my podcasts that was not that long ago. And she's like, you know, it sounds weird because you didn't mention the insurrection. And like, I was thinking, like, dear God, things are moving so fast at this point.
Yeah.
That just releasing a podcast within a few days, it's dated because you didn't mention the bizarre fucking thing that happened.
Yeah, no. And we're talking right now before inauguration. We don't know what's going to happen on inauguration,
But right before we did this podcast, I did see on the news that they had to stop the rehearsal because a homeless encampment nearby had burst into flames.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but that has got, I mean, like if you saw that in a movie, it would seem cheesy.
Yeah.
Like really, that's your statement on homelessness and capitalism? I get it. The homeless encampment's going to disrupt the whole political system. Like, come on. There's got to be a more nuanced way to say that.
Come on. Come on, reality.
it's so wild, man. These events are happening with such great rapidity that who knows? But I wonder if you could let people know where they can find your book and if there's anything you want to say to promote this wonderful book, because it's really good. And I'm sorry. Is this available? When does this become available?
Tomorrow.
The 19th. Hell yes. Perfect. Yeah. Are you excited, David? That's got to feel so crazy.
I'm pretty excited. The book release date got pushed back. It was supposed to come out in October.
Yeah.
I feel like I've been sitting on this for a while. So I'm really excited to get it out in the world.
Have you started doing other interviews in this yet? Are you about to do a press tour?
Not really much of a press tour. Releasing a book during COVID is going to be really interesting.
I'm doing a
conversation with Gillian Flynn tomorrow night.
Cool.
At Bookseller. In my neighborhood, there's a book place called Bookseller. It's just,
you feel robbed of a book tour? Are you you probably won't be able to do a book tour until
I won't.
Good or bad?
I don't know. I mean, like the best part about it is I get to just get back to writing.
But no, let me tell you how you feel. It's bad, David. Like you need a book tour. You deserve a book tour for this, where you go and you read passages from this book to people who are dressed in like hot cosplay outfits.
Ooh, that would be awesome. But no. What are you gonna do? The last time I released a book, it came out during a polar vortex where it was like -40.
Yeah.
And so like every book is gonna have its problems.
Right.
It's launch. So if this is the problem, okay.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's like hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives. I'm upset because you can't go hang out with furries.
I'm a little upset that I can't hang out with furries, but oh well. You know, if they would just put filters into those masks, everything would be fine.
Holy shit. And with that, David McLean changed. The pandemic was over in a week as the world started wearing furry masks with HEPA filters in them. David, I'm sorry for the clumsy end of this podcast. I am really excited for you. This book is so fucking good. And
thanks,
it's going to do great.
Means a lot.
Because it's so good. All the links y'all need to find this book are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. Also, after you finish reading How I Learned to Hate in Ohio, definitely pick up The Answer to the Riddle Is Me. That's David's memoir about amnesia in India. And it is right up there with, what's that freaking awesome book by Krakauer about Everest? What's that called, David?
Oh, yeah, Into Thin Air.
Into Thin Air. I put it on the same level as Into Thin Air. It's that freaking good. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Duncan.
Best to your family. Thanks for being on the show.
I love you. Good luck with the big change in your life coming up.
Thank you, friend. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
That was David McLean, everybody. Please order his book, How I Learned to Hate in Ohio. Follow him on Twitter, reach out to him through the astral plane, and give him a big, fat kiss on his beautiful, beautiful nipples. Big thanks to our sponsors, and most of all, a big thank you to you, my listeners, who have allowed me to have the coolest job on planet Earth. I love you, and I'll see you next week, and maybe somewhere in here I'll find time to tell you the wild story of the birth of my sweet second son. Lots to talk about. I'll see you soon. Hare Krishna.